This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran starts enriching uranium to 60% purity level at its Fordo facility in response to the IAEA's latest resolution. Yemeni armed forces say they have stopped a foreign ship from stealing the nation's oil at a southern port. Plus, Russia calls for restraint after Turkey targets the positions of Kurdish militants in northeastern Syria. Welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran says it has started enriching uranium to 60% purity at its Fordo nuclear site. That is in response to a recent anti-Iran resolution by the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The measures outlined by the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran also include replacing the facility's centrifuges with advanced IR-6 machines. Two cascades of advanced centrifuges have also been installed at a separate site in Natanz. It is already enriching uranium to a 60% purity. Iran says these are initial measures after the U.S. and the three European countries got the anti-Iran resolution ratified in the IAEA on Thursday. It accuses Iran of lack of cooperation with the agency. Tehran has described the resolution as politically motivated. It is warning some Western countries are trying to hinder cooperation between Tehran and the UN agency. The Belarusian Prime Minister Roman Gurchenko is in Iran on an official visit focused on expansion of bilateral ties. He was officially welcomed by Iran's first Vice President Mohammad Mokhber at the Saadabad Palace a short while ago. He is heading a high-ranking delegation during his one-day trip. Belarusian and Iranian officials are set to discuss ways to enhance mutual cooperation in different fields, including agriculture, transit, and energy, among other things. The visit follows agreements reached between Iranian and Belarusian presidents on the sidelines of the recent summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization held in the Uzbek capital in Tashkent. Tehran University professor Fuad Izadi says that the West confrontational approach will backfire in the long run as it gives Iran cold feet and voluntary cooperation with the UN nuclear agency.
You know, I think the real motive behind this resolution is actually to force Iranian officials to stop cooperating with the agency. They want to take the case to the UN Security Council, and by passing this type of politically motivated resolutions, they want to basically create a scene where Iran, given the fact that these type of resolutions are politically motivated, it stops its cooperation with IAEA. In practice, what will happen is that Iran will follow NPT guidelines when it comes to IAEA cooperation, but Iran will do the absolute minimum, nothing more than what is required. Yeah, so this type of practice is actually going to backfire in the long run. Because the access, the extra access that Iran was providing under the JCPOA is going to disappear totally, and it's going to be the other side that's going to lose the access that they had more than what Iran was supposed to do.
The Yemeni army says it has thwarted an attempt by an enemy tanker to plunder the country's oil in the south. In a series of tweets, the army spokesman said the ship was on a mission to steal, quote, enormous amounts of oil from the port of Al-Daba. Yahya Sari added that the Yemeni armed forces adequately dealt with the ship after it refused to heed warnings. He further vowed that the Yemeni armed forces would continue to protect the country's resources. In recent weeks, Yemen says that it has foiled in at least two other attempts by the Saudi-led coalition to loot its oil. Yemenis say the Saudi-led coalition looted more than $13 billion worth of the country's oil between 2016 and 2021. The coalition launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Yusuf Mauri, says the former Saudi-backed government in Yemen is the main reason behind the plunder of the country's oil.
These foreign companies, they seem to have contracts and deals in place with members of the Saudi-backed government, which basically sold these companies and these nations Yemeni oil below international market price. And the Saudi-backed Yemeni government is basically dependent on this revenue stream to make profit. And this hasn't been the case for the past month and a half as the Ansar Allah movement continues to force these oil companies to turn back without any Yemeni oil. The Ansar Allah movement, as they mentioned, they believe that, you know, countries such as the U.S., the British government and the UN, they're allowing this war to continue so that Yemen's natural resources continue to be extorted, so that Yemeni oil and Yemeni gas can continue to be plundered from the nation, right? And this was the case. This is a similar pattern that we've seen happen every time one of these nations launches a war on a country in the Middle East. We've seen this, you know, in Iraq, where a war was launched and the country's natural resources and oil was plundered from the country. We've seen this happen in Syria, and apparently, you know, this is also the case here in Yemen, and this has been happening for the past 8 years.
Russia urges Turkey to exercise restraint in using excessive military force in Syria after Ankara launched airstrikes against Kurdistan and the Kurdish militants in the country. Russian media cited an envoy to Syria as saying that Moscow hopes to convince Ankara to prevent tensions on Syrian territory from escalating. He reportedly said that Russia would help settle what he called the Kurdish issue peacefully. On Sunday, Turkey conducted airstrikes against bases of Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK, in Iraq and their affiliate, YPG, in northeastern Syria. The offensive came days after a bomb hit Istanbul, leaving scores of casualties. Ankara blamed the PKK for the attack, but the Kurdish militants denied any involvement. The Turkish president has also threatened to launch a ground offensive against the Kurdish militants in Syria. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has carried out drone and missile strikes against neighboring Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. The IRGC says the strikes targeted the remaining positions of terrorists and separatist groups operating against Iran. We discuss this in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review section. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it's carried out fresh drone and missile strikes against neighboring Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. The IRGC says that the strikes targeted the remaining positions of terrorists and separatist groups operating against Iran. The force says that the raids hit locations deep into the Kurdistan region and destroyed their targets. According to the IRGC, the attacks dealt a heavy blow to the terrorists. The force has carried out three rounds of such strikes in northern Iraq recently. Iran says that Iraq's federal government has a responsibility to prevent any threats coming from the Arab country's northern Kurdistan region. Now, allow me to invite a couple of guests to see what they think about this. So we have Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator in London. Also with us is Faraz Al Najam, manager with the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights in Toronto. Good to see you, gentlemen. Welcome. Now, Mohsen Abbas, this is the umpteenth time I remember announcing here myself Iran giving warning to Iraq, both the central government and the Kurdistan region, against allowing Iraqi soil to turn into a hub for terrorist operations and for any threat or menace coming Iran's way from inside Iraqi soil. But unfortunately, no practical action. Promises have been made lots of times, but no practical action on the ground. And this is, I don't know how many times, but IRIB has been doing this recently, and they say that they have to do it because they are entitled to provide and ensure security for Iran. Let's have your thoughts on this.
Well, it's getting increasingly crucial. It has, of course, been a long-running situation, this problem within the Kurdish region. And Iran, as you rightly say, has been trying to have it resolved to no avail, it seems. And now, as they say, the chickens are coming home to roost, because it's that very corridor of the Iraqi Kurdistan region where a lot of the weapons, a lot of the supplies, and a lot of the current insurgents as well within Iran are taking huge support through basically. And what's the background to this region's connections to the enemies of Iran? Well, that's really important, and I people often don't maybe cite this, but Israel has a huge presence in this northern Iraqi Kurdistani region, and they've had it for decades. 1931 was the earliest Israeli connection with the Kurds through Reuven Shiloh, who was the future Mossad director, who actually laid the grounds for most of the alliances they have in that region. The 1950s saw the Israelis come up with the periphery doctrine, which meant Israel would make friends with all of the non-Arab peoples around or surrounding the Arabs, and the Odin-Yinon plan in 1982 consolidated this. Kurdish-Israeli relations are very warm economically as well as militarily. It's been time and time, Seymour Hersh, for instance, was one journalist who exposed that the Israelis were training Kurds on the ground, and there are known to be Israeli corporate companies working on, for instance, Erbil Airport and other signs of Israeli interference within that region. All of this means basically Israel has been not only destabilizing Iraq through these Kurdish forces, who they've been encouraging with the temptation of a Kurdish state in the not too distant future, and they're also destabilizing Iran, and as you can see, Turkey and Syria are also affected, but they're playing a lot of the Turkish groups off each other as well, and using different ones for different operations. And the ones that are dealing with Iran, well, the IRGC has gone after them yet again this week, and with again a warning. In the long run, could it be that Iran needs to carry out an actual on-the-ground military operation to clear out those Israeli-backed Kurds who are basically creating insurgencies and huge insurrectionist problems for Iran as well now, as well as Iraq?
Okay. Now, Francois Nejem, how do you look at this issue? From what angle? And who do you think is sponsoring all those terrorist operations that are happening from inside Iraqi soil in the Kurdistan region? Because, you know, Iran and Iraq have good and brotherly ties, but this is happening.
Yes, it's clear if you look at the history of Mas'ud Barzani, the one leading the north of Iraq, so-called Kurdistan region. He's had a lot of relations with Saddam in the earlier stage, and he's very friendly with the Americans. And also, it's well known that he's very friendly with the Israelis, and there's a lot of Israeli companies and organizations working inside the north of Iraq. And the Iraqi government has spoken against this many times, and certain MPs have spoken against this and threatened also military action. And at a certain point, also he tried to cause sedition by separating the north of Iraq from Iraq, and he did a referendum. It was like a plot. It was kind of like a scheme that he wanted to do really quick, and he failed miserably at that time, because the Iraqi army and the popular mobilization forces mobilized really quick and stopped this type of sedition and type of division in the Middle East, West Asia, as Sayyid Khamenei calls it. So, you know, the north of Iraq, you know, it's a project that's trying to prop up and spread this project all over the different countries such as Iran and Turkey. They want to separate Kurdish, areas where, you know, they're predominantly Kurdish there. And they're inflaming and also empowering them by the West. Like they're supporting these separatists and these people that are terrorist organizations such as PKK and different organizations. And that's why Turkey continuously hits them. That's why Iran continuously hits them. And Iraq is always under threat because of their, evil acts and so on. And hopefully this evil project of building this, you know, Kurdistan region and separating from the whole, from each country will be dismantled, hopefully. And the IRGC are doing a great job at fighting terrorism, inside Iran right now, terrorist groups that are empowered by the West and also empowered by the north of Iraq based there through the system inside the north of Iraq. At the same time, they fought fiercely against the terrorists in Syria, and they also helped and secured Iraq by fighting ISIS. So, you know, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps are really an anti-terrorist organization and force. Unfortunately, the West paints them as their terrorist organization. It's the total opposite. And, this is just a manipulation and a fabrication for an evil agenda of the West to dominate and divide and conquer the whole region. But the IRGC force is very, very powerful, and hopefully they will deal with the situation.
Okay. Thank you so much for that, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas in London, Firas al-Najm in Toronto with our comments and contribution.
Ukrainians are bracing for a harsh winter as Russian strikes cripple the country's power capacity. Temperatures are already below freezing in several areas, including the capital, Kiev. President Volodymyr Zelensky is urging Ukrainians to conserve electricity. He says half of the country's power capacity had been knocked out by Russian rockets. A major energy provider has said millions of Ukrainians are most likely to live with blackouts until the end of March. On Thursday, a barrage of Russian missiles hit Ukrainian cities, including Kiev. Local officials say many of such attacks hit the energy infrastructure. One in seven households in Spain is suffering from food insecurity due to low income. According to the National Statistics Institute, food prices were 15.4% higher in October from a year earlier. To ease pressure on the households, the government has introduced subsidies for transport, a one-off payment of 200 euros for the unemployed, and a 15% increase in pensions for the most vulnerable. But charities that work with the poor say the measures are not enough. Europe is reeling from the economic shockwaves of a war in Ukraine that has led to a surge in inflation and energy costs. China's defense minister says Taiwan is at the center of the country's core interests and it is a red line the U.S. should not cross. Wei Feng says that the issue has nothing to do with the external forces and it is for the Chinese people to decide. He made the comments in a meeting with his U.S. counterpart Lloyd Austin, who reiterated that the U.S. is committed to the One China policy and opposed the unilateral changes to Taiwan's status quo. Austin also raised concern about what he called increasingly dangerous behavior by Chinese military aircraft in the Indo-Pacific region. The two powers are at loggerheads over their military activities, as well as Taiwan, which China considers as part of its territory. The tensions over Taiwan have increased since the U.S. House Speaker visited the island in August. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Discovering Islam. Based on the Islamic teachings, the soul lives after the body is dead and decomposed. Based on the same teachings, the souls will be resurrected in their bodies on the Day of Judgment. However, the question is, where would the soul go in the interim period between death and the Day of Judgment? Would they live, or they will be in a state of oblivion? If they live, what type of life they would have? Do they feel happiness and pleasure and pain and agony? What about those souls who have not lived enough to attain merit or demerit? What about the children? What type of life they would have in that interim period? The world of the dead is usually portrayed as the most terrifying realm man has ever imagined, the realm of spooks. We are usually frightened even to think about it. However, based on the Islamic teachings, what comes after death and before the resurrection of the dead is a fascinating world.
The phases of our existence are divided into two. One is called al-dunya, this world, and one is called al-akhirah, what happens afterwards, the hereafter. Dunya is roughly divided into our existence as we walk about on earth and our existence when we lie under the ground. One is dunya, one is barzakh. Both of them are still dunya. They are not akhirah. So we define dunya as everything that happens before the blowing of the trumpet that brings an end to all this life, and that is divided into earthly life and barzakh.
Okay, there is the dunya and there is the akhirah. Okay, two very distinct. But there is a buffer world, or a world that in a way brings the two together. You know, it separates the physical world of the laws of physics and the world of spirits. And the two, you know, because of their very different laws and incompatibility, really.
In barzakh, the souls, if you like, are kept in waiting till the rest of humanity catches up with them, so that then they can enter the new phase of their existence, which is to be arrayed in front of their Lord on the Day of Judgment.
With death, we enter a world of wonders. We will have dreamlike experiences which is far more different from what we now know.
The awareness in Barzakh of an individual, believer or unbeliever, is vastly superior to the awareness of even the greatest scholars who are alive now, because there is an element of certainty in the vision that you have in Barzakh, which is difficult to get in this world.
This stage of our life, or this stage of journey towards the Lord, is called with different names in Islamic literature. It is sometimes referred to as the middle world, or the world of images, Alamul Mithal, or the barrier world, Barzakh.
Barzakh is a variety of passages into the hereafter.
Something that separates two things is a barzakh. And that's why this realm is called the barzakh, because it divides this life that we live in right now from the hereafter. Although it's a very, very long time in between, nonetheless, since it divides these two from each other and separates them, it has been called the barzakh, where people go.
We call it barzakh because there is an impregnable barrier between that dimension and the dimension in which we live now. It cannot be penetrated back after the soul has passed through it with the help of the angel of death. Now, the Quran states that after they die, behind them is a barrier until the day they are resurrected.
The Quran states, and beyond them is a barzakh, or a barrier, before the day in which they will be brought forth. So the Quranic picture of barzakh is some sort of intermediary phase before the major day of resurrection.
Barzakh in Arabic just means barrier, something that separates two things, like we have, for example, in the verse in Surah Rahman, that the sweet water and the salty water have a barzakh between them. And you know, these waters can travel together without mixing because there is this impenetrable barrier between them. In the same way, this barzakh, the intermediary world, because it is a buffer, if you like, between life and world, life of this world, and the day of judgment. And these are one-way streets. People do not come back from them.
There is a point in the near-death experience that a lot of people mention, in which they have a point of decision, let's say. It could be sometimes a barrier that they are going to pass, or sometimes it's just a perception that if they move on, it's like a decision made, either I come back or I stay. Come back, I mean, to the intraphysical life, to their lives back.
When we talk about the world of graves, we do not talk about the physical bodies buried here, rotten after a while. We talk about a world of a different dimension. We talk about the souls living in the spiritual bodies. Although they are connected to our world, but they live in a completely different dimension.
The grave referring to here, of course, is a spiritual grave, not the physical grave. You might have an individual who may not even have a grave. God forbid someone dies in the sea and, let's say, maybe eaten up by the animals of the sea. So he or she may not even have a grave. But what we're talking about is the spiritual grave, not the physical grave.
Where is the soul of this body now? Does it really live inside this? According to our knowledge and according to the traditions that we have been taught, the soul is not related to this body anymore. The soul is living in a spiritual body. This body, whether rotten or kept intact, is of no use anymore.
The question that comes up is, why is it necessary to even have a barzakh realm, a barzakh world that we go to after death? Why not go straight to the hereafter? First of all, there's a fixed time for the hereafter. And in the Quran it says, عِلْمُهَا عِنْدَ رَبِّي, and the knowledge of the hour is with my Lord. So that has a fixed time, and now we're living in this life. And at the same time, we believe that the soul doesn't die. The body will die, will deteriorate. But the soul is to live on. Okay, so where is it going to be? What's going to happen? Because the hereafter hasn't arrived yet. The day of judgment hasn't arrived yet. Well, that's where it's going to be then. It's going to be somewhere. That somewhere where the soul is residing is called the barzakh.
What is the purpose of barzakh? My idea is that, of course, the day of judgment is a day when there will be a collective presence of humanity. But humankind comes to the earth and leaves the earth in groups. We don't all come together and we don't all leave together. But on the day of judgment, we all have to arrive together, which means that we need a holding area.
In this seir and this traveling towards Allah and movement towards Allah, this soul is developing slowly. They say that the barzakh is a place where souls are prepared either for the punishment or for the great rewards. In the barzakh, it is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will sometimes have people compensate for what they missed in this life so that they don't miss out on the good stuff on that side. Of course, it doesn't mean that we have a chance to do good deeds there. That is done. But still, those good deeds that we did in this life, those good intentions that some might have had in this life, will have an effect on their development in the barzakh.
The traits that we allow our souls to be occupied in, or the dispositions that we form in this world, they become like the seeds germinated within fertile ground. They sprout and they come to the fullness of their existence, just like a baby through the influence of DNA becomes a fully grown baby, a fetus, before they arrive into this world. So before we arrive into the next world, we fully mature in accordance with those dispositions that we have brought upon our own selves within this world.
It's in that dimension which question about the past life of every individual buried takes place. And that is the world of the grave. That is Alamul Mithal.
Mithal means image, but not like the image we see in the mirror. Rather, it's an image not dependent on mass and matter, hence more abundant with life and freshness.
Sorrow and happiness, pain and pleasure, and any other quality that we experience in this world are but faint shadows reflected from that world on the dull face of the matter. A world in which the heaviness of the matter does not slow down the life, just like what we see in our dreams or experience in our imagination.
The pleasure and the pain of that world and the duration of that world can never be likened to this world, because in this world everything is watered down. My fullness of my pleasures cannot come to the fore, nor my pains or my fears, because there are limitations through matter. But in that world, there are no limitations.
The spiritual grave could be either a place of garden, heaven, paradise. Someone feels that he or she is receiving the blessings of God Almighty. Or it could be one of the pits of fire where the punishment will constantly endure.
The soul is subjected to confinement, pain, punishment, sickness, and grief, as they are to various states of joy, rest, bliss, and freedom. Now, all these are, of course, experienced in the spiritual body and not by the physical body.
In Barzakh, we would feel pain, sorrow, and happiness, absolutely, because these are aspects that deal with the nafs, and it does not deal with the physical body. Although they say there are some happy hormones in the body, there are some painful hormones in the body, but these would come as consequences, you know. So the soul or the nafs is what feels the pain and the pleasure. And that, since it never dies, it's not the physical body that feels the pain and the pleasure. No, it's reflected on the physical body, but it's actually the soul or the nafs that is feeling it.
The Quran states that the life of this world is just play and sport, and that the real life will come in the hereafter. As the middle world or barzakh is one step ahead towards the hereafter, the life there must be much richer than what is experienced here.
The whole context that we understand this world is different over there. And therefore it's very difficult for that human being. And same thing when the day of resurrection. Everything we know about that world and this world is going to be completely different as well.
This life is seen in Islam and the Quranic vision of Islam as being purely instrumental. It is a means to something much more. Okay, this life is simply a process through which we can start to fulfill the divine potential which is within us, to live beyond the bounds and limits of this material world.
When the souls arrive in Barzakh, they find themselves in a new form of living in which the intensity of life and its dimensions are exponentially increased. The soul in its mithali body is the swiftest thing in moving, relocating, ascending or descending from one place to another. However, based on the degree of their completion, they can be divided into various categories.
One cannot imagine how exciting the arrival of the soul to that world may be. It's so lush, so astonishing, so glorious, that it leaves the soul to marvel for a long time. It's an experience like the birth of the baby into this world from the womb. Now, the difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, whereas the baby's soul is very astute and can feel the difference.
There is a constant progression towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at whatever age we go. The soul is not really bothered with whether it is 20 years old or 200 years old when it leaves the body. It is still very young in the great journey that is yet to come. It is an infant. It's just a case of relativeness. Yeah? Because when you're talking about the Day of Judgment itself being 50,000 years long, and Barzakh, God knows how many hundreds of thousands of years long, 200 years or 2 years, all becomes very relative. The soul is still young, it has a lot of maturity and a lot of learning to do still.
By entering into that world, the soul moves one step forward, and its powers to comprehend the realities of existence increase. It is now one stage closer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord.
When the Prophet went to the dead of the Meccans that lay on the battlefield of Badr, he said, "Do you find the promise of God to be true?" The Sahaba said, "Ya Rasulullah, bal amwat." "O Messenger, these are dead people." He said, "No, asma'a minkum wa absar." He said, "No, they hear more than you do, and they see more than you do."
People in Barzakh are of different types, much more diverse than we see in this world. They eat and drink, but not of things of this world, and dwell, but not in places of this world.
Their food and drink and dress, their houses and furniture, their cities and neighborhoods are of diverse and dissimilar kinds. They may be poor or rich, beautiful or ugly, and happy or miserable. They are all based on what they have done in this world.
The Islamic tradition has references to three groups. Group number one, the believers. Again, I stress on the fact, believers, not Muslims. A disbeliever can be a Muslim. The believers who have acted in accordance with their faith, they practice what they preached, those will be enjoying some of the features of heaven in that world. On the other side, the second group, the disbelievers, could be Muslims, are unfortunately suffering from some of the punishments that they will be subjected to in the hereafter, after the Day of Judgment. And there's a third group who some of the tradition describe as they are neither the first group nor the second group. They are a group of people who maybe they were not subjected to enough knowledge. They will be in a state of as if they were asleep. God will just leave them.
For believers, life in Barzakh is going to be fascinating. They live in vast expanses with bespoke landscapes around mansions and palaces furnished with luxurious furniture in their lounges and rooms.
They are served by innumerable some number of servants with inner and outer beauty with no purpose but to serve their masters. Now bear in mind that none of these are physical objects. They all belong to the spiritual world, a world an image of which is reflected in our world.
All these are there to strengthen their love and appreciation for the God they are going to meet after this stage of their life. However, we have to be careful not to confuse this exuberant life with what awaits them in the eternal paradise, as the quality of life there is in no way comparable with what they experience here in the middle world.
We have a basic understanding of what paradise has: the beautiful scenery, the palaces, the service, the gardens. But actually there's more to it. Meeting the Lord, proximity to Allah, seeing Allah with the heart, seeing God with the heart, is a theme that the Quran encourages people to think about.
Here we need to talk about one other type of life in Barzakh. The life of those who have died at a young age and have not developed into good or evil souls.
Compared to the grown-ups, the children who die at a young age have one advantage and one disadvantage. Now, on the positive side, they are sinless and hence open to any concept and wisdom that the angels may teach them. On the negative side, they have not developed concepts, feelings, and thoughts which are prerequisite for ultimate wisdom.
The views about what judgment will be passed on those who have died at a young age differ. Most Christian theologians believe that only those children who are baptized would attain salvation. The majority of Muslim theologians, however, believe that every child who has died at a young age would be saved.
If a child dies before he has the mental maturity to choose between right and wrong, that child will continue to exist because he was born for eternity, but he will not, of course, be subjected to any judgment because he didn't have the mental capacity to choose.
They can only be taught to a restricted degree, and deeper aspects of wisdom cannot be known by them.
These teachings have two aspects. One, to teach them the wisdom and the knowledge that are prerequisites for entering that realm. And two, to cleanse them from the wrong teachings given to them by their parents or their society that is a hindrance for entering the holy realm.
Their purity is very different from the purity of the grown-ups. It is this latter purity and the depth of wisdom corresponding to it which determine the place of every individual in the final abode.
We have people out there who envy those who die at a young age. They say this child, this youth, he died before getting a chance to sin and before getting the chance to become a bad person. He's so lucky. But if you look at it from Allah's perspective, it's not necessarily something good.
Children cannot enter the territory of the righteous immediately after death. They live in a very beautiful interim space under the guidance and training of the angels to prepare them for entering that realm.
It's not an art. It's not something big to evade the punishment of the hereafter. That's not what we're here for. Not going to the hellfire is not something hard. It's easy. Allah's mercy is too great. Allah will forgive with the slightest excuse. What's hard is to gain higher levels of closeness to Him. So this isn't something that we should actually ask for. A person who dies young didn't have the chance to develop. Of course, it doesn't mean that he's going to be in a bad position on that day, but he won't, or she won't, benefit from all the good stuff either.
One cannot wait to see the wonders we are promised in the world of Barzakh, a world which takes us one step further to our final destination, meeting with the Lord, a world which empowers us to an extent unimaginable for us in this life. However, we have not exhausted all our topics about the fascinations of the world of Barzakh. Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about those topics. Until then, peace be with you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
فقه و جورسپروденس
is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked...
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of...
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned. Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha states, "Be careful of your deeds. At the moment, since the angels of Allah are recording all of them." This means that even our minor deeds are recorded and we see the results of our actions in the other world. Based on the Holy Quran, a great reward awaits those who did even a minor goodness in this world. According to Islamic narrations, if a wife loves her husband and shows her love even with giving a glass of water to him, this action of her will be equal to worshipping Allah during the nights and fasting during the days for 1 year. This means that true affection and love, even if it is through a little deed like serving water, will be rewarded so much by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thus, all our minor deeds are even recorded by Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio.